Brave New World.
Hello and welcome to Brave New World programme. I'm John Harrison. And the year 2016 has, I suppose, taught us what with Brexit, the US elections, growing anti-EU sentiment on the continent of Europe, that ignoring national interests, which are more and more often expressed in terms of national culture and identity, is really not possible anymore. Will this translate through into the regeneration or the reconstruction of economic protectionism in a way that will be acceptable to populations, as governments will want to consolidate their positions based on agendas of national identity? To discuss this issue, I welcome to the programme Professor Steve Keen from the University of Kingston. Professor Keen is an economist and an author. Welcome to the programme, Professor Keen.
Good to be here.
Now, we can start off with a sort of general question, please. In your opinion, are culture and identity basically now the new important subjects in politics?
Well, I think there's been an identification with the progressive version of identity and gender politics and so on, with neoliberal economics at the same time. They've been bedfellows for the last 40 years. And one of the most egregious examples there, I'd say, is France, where you have Hollande as a socialist leader who's been imposing austerity policies while talking about identity, you know, positive attitudes towards progressive identity politics. And what's actually happened as a result of this is that the progressive identity politics have been tarred with the brush of the austerity policies imposed by the European Union there, and the socialists have been sunk by it and facing a resurgent Marine Le Pen, who's talking about the identity of neglected white farmers and the countryside and neglected white workers, as Trump doing in America. So I think we've always had identity politics as part of our global politics. It's been a mistake, and a very big mistake, by the left to align themselves with neoliberal economics and, in effect, end up tarring their progressive version of identity politics with a failed economic policy, which is now, as is now falling apart. It's now legitimate right-wing politics. And the sort of economics, in some ways, which critics of mainstream economics like myself were saying the left should have been supporting for the last 40 years.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose now it's very difficult for the left to sort of, we made a mistake, and repaint themselves in a different colour that's sort of less neoliberal, and perhaps get on board some of the other ideas that are floating around, isn't it? I mean, that's going to take a few years to realign themselves if they wish to do that at all.
I know, and that's my reason I use France as an example, is because there's a new socialist candidate there is suddenly coming out and talking in terms of economic nationalism for economic policy, and we're going to, you know, boost workers' wages and protect the state, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. It's a bit like after the last 4 or 5 years of going along with the EU. And the same applies with the Labour Party here in England. The whole attitude about the Blairite Party, kicked in the figuratives by the left here now, they really are in quite disarray. They don't quite know what to do.
So, in a way, you could say that the sort of the idea of the old left and right wings in politics, you know, the so-called conservatives and the so-called socialists, is being dissolved or has been dissolved by a general underlying support for neoliberalism on both sides of the wings. And this, both of them now are supporting, I suppose, a resurgence then of nationalism, but they're called different things, aren't they, in the different parties, but it's basically the same thing. Do you agree with that?
Largely. I mean, the centre-left really basically said, if we're going to get into power, it's only worthwhile if we get into power. To get into power, we have to make capitalism work better.
Yeah.
Let's grab Economics Textbook 101 and read through that and see what it says will make capitalism work better. We'll do that while we do all the progressive stuff for gays and women and so on, and make everything work better while improving the social system. And it's been a complete travesty, because Economics 101 is a load of garbage. And what instead they've done is they've ended up deregulating the financial sector, letting it rip, causing prosperity by leverage. And then when that came crashing down in 2008, goodbye the successful economy. They still have really no idea why that's happened. What they've done in this process is identify those progressive social policies with the failed neoliberal policy. And the main sufferers from that neoliberal policy have been what used to be the industrial workers of the capitalist West. And then our saying, well, if you buggers can't protect us, we're going across to the people who might be able to. And as ugly as they, you might think they are, we're going to vote for them because we need to throw a human hand grenade into the political system to get you to wake up.
Yeah.
And that's what I regard Trump as, largely a human hand grenade thrown by the working class of America, which has been neglected both ideologically by the left, but also and economically, because the policies that have been implemented really did make them lose their jobs to the benefit of those in China, as Trump has been arguing.
Yeah, I mean, this is a basic economic fact, isn't it? It's also an economic fact that using cultural identity slogans to win elections and to consolidate parties' power, would it not lead to a new form of economic protectionism? I mean, are we far away now from the reintroduction of tariffs, trade tariffs? America, definitely, and I guess the UK, you know, as we're heading out of Brexit or supposed to be out of Europe.
To some extent, I mean, the trouble is that all this stuff is half-baked in both directions.
Yeah.
If you look at the conventional economic theory argues in favor of what they call comparative advantage and says that the best thing for economy to grow is to specialize in what it's good at. And this theory was swallowed by most economists, actually, not just mainstream economists, but a lot of progressive economists as well, can't help but think that way because it's so ingrained in the thinking of economists right from the days of David Ricardo. But if you take a good empirical look at this theory, and that's been done by groups like the Economic Complexity Lab at Harvard University, which is staffed not by economists but by computer scientists, mm-hmm. and looking at the data that they find is the advice that they would give empirically is the exact opposite of the mainstream advice. Rather than specialization cause it leading to growth, the economies that grow best are the most diversified.
Right.
And so what we've had running along an axis where it's protection versus free trade. And in fact, it's a much more complex picture than that. And when we look at it empirically, unfortunately, we don't actually get to the stage where the wisdom is leaped upon. It would say what we should be doing is not worrying about specialization, but diversification. We should be trying to build a diversified industrial structure and focusing upon technological change and evolution of new industries rather than specialization. That would be the wise way to go about it. But because we've been pushed so far in favor of free trade,
yes,
with a knee-jerk reaction opposite direction, we're going to probably go back to protection and tariffs without really doing it in a particularly intelligent fashion.
Let's take a short break here and continue this fascinating conversation.
Brave New World.
Welcome back to Brave New World. My name's John Harrison. Today I'm talking with Professor Steve Keen, an economist and author. And Professor Keen lectures at the University of Kingston in London. And we're talking about a new era of economic protectionism, which could be coming about as a result of cultural protectionism. Now, Professor Keen, we just touched on the subject of trade tariffs. I mean, and you have very clearly said, you know, that we shouldn't really be imposing tariffs, should we? This is not to the collective benefit. And yet, we're looking at a situation where this will probably happen.
Well, it's again, the argument is that we should be reducing tariffs and that will make the economy grow more rapidly is intellectually moribund, but takes equally dominant in economics at the same time.
Yeah.
The real picture is much more complex than that. And if you look at work of people like Danny Roddick, who's done some of the very good empirical work on what actually has been done by countries that have grown successfully.
Mm-hmm.
Countries like South Korea, Japan, China, and so on, they did protect their industries in the early stages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they also put them under pressure to develop rapidly. They would drop, they put up tariff barriers or any other control they could make do to try to direct economic demand towards domestic production rather than imports. But they then put them under immense pressure to have to industrialize by either dropping the tariffs or reducing the controls over time. And that had the effect of meaning that to survive, those companies which hid behind the tariff wall, first of all, had to develop and diversify and aim to be export capable,
mm-hmm.
Rather than just looking for the after the domestic industry.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine going back to the 1960s, and as a child in the 1960s, I remember these conversations vividly. Kids would laugh about Japanese cars, what a load of junk they were, and you're much better off buying a Ford or a Holden. Fast 50 years, and the junk at the Holden or the Ford, comparatively, the Japanese cars are the sophisticated ones.
Yeah.
So that's the process that Roddick has found. You defend your industry, first of all. You push them so that they industrialize and develop their technology rapidly. And at a later stage, you then go for free trade because you're now competitive with the rest of the world. So that's that means that what really leads to growth is industrial development at home and innovation, not liberalization. There's going to be a battle between different political wings, and we're going to probably go into ignorant protection rather than sensible industrial development.
But in a way, forgive me if I sound confronting, but are you not saying then that it's okay to outsource your industries, you know, to countries which support lower wage policies?
No, I'm actually saying the opposite.
Okay.
Okay. What China took advantage of, and I was actually in China in 81, 82, and I saw the free trade zone in Shenzhen as the concrete was being poured for the trade zone. They very much knew they were taking advantage of a loophole in the American trade laws that enable the country, a company to export unfinished goods to a third world country, have them work there using cheap labor, and import them back into America without paying tariffs on the additional work being done. The Chinese knew they were going to exploit that to, first of all, get hold of the Western technology as soon as possible. Secondly, get employment for their workers coming out of the very moribund Maoist period they'd been under before that.
Right.
But thirdly, develop a capitalist class, because they required any firm that took advantage of those low wages to have a Chinese partner. And within 5 years' time, the Chinese partner had to own half the business. That's how companies like Foxconn actually came about. So that was a very successful strategy for China. It was a negative one for the working class of America. And that's what we're now seeing the impact of.
Right. Now, this impact on the working class of America, could this now then affect globalization as we know it today, the general kind of policy of West to East, with very little action happening in the other direction?
Yeah, I think it's going to affect it quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. But mind you, at the same time, there's also technological pressures that are going in the same direction because of the development of robotics, much more advanced than we were, say, 50 years ago. You don't have the labor advantage you used to have out of cheap labor anymore. And in fact, Foxconn, for example, is spending a large amount of money to replace its own labor with robots right now. So the same thing can apply back in America. They've got to develop the technology. I think the Chinese are ahead of them now, and certainly the Japanese are. But with that, there's no longer an advantage of low wages.
What about universal basic income? Do you see that as being a sort of future economic practice?
I think we have to go in that direction because, in some ways, the strength of the working class for the last 1.5 centuries of capitalism has come out of the fact that you have to have workers to produce output, and therefore there's some bargaining power, and that's where the wealth that we generate, actually really from exploiting the energy we find on the planet, has been shared between workers and capitalists. But if you get into the stage where you can produce that output without labor virtually whatsoever, certainly without unskilled labor as an input, and in the next 50 years that is technologically quite feasible, then the working class is either screwed in a class of Hunger Games sense, or you have to go to a universal basic income and say we're going to spread the wealth we generate out of exploiting this energy and our technology.
And keep supporting a system whereby people actually buy products which are produced.
Yeah.
Can we just sum up, please? My basic question is, will the new politics that are coming in willy-nilly all over the world, as people are talking about it, you know, taking up political discussion time, and they're talking more about national identity and, I guess, coming roots in culture, you know, what does it mean to be British? What does it mean to be French? What does it mean to America? Let's make America great again. In a nutshell, will all this lead to resurgence of economic protectionism or not?
I think it will, and I don't trust humanity's capacity to do these things intelligently. There'll be a knee-jerk element to it.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, at the same time, it's actually good to promote the diversity so long as you respect the other forms of diversity on the planet. We don't want to go back to the master race attitude. But the great trouble is that in reaction to one catastrophe, we tend to lurch into another.
Fantastic. Professor Stephen Keane, economist and author, and working at the University of Kingston. Thank you very much indeed for being with us today. It's absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much, listeners, for being with us. I think it's an interesting program. Goodbye.